Tonight we're learning about the Talmud. Last week we learned the Mishnah. What does Mishnah mean? Oral Torah. Exactly, it's the Oral Torah. But it's not oral anymore, is it? It's written. It's written down. It was written down in around the year 200 Common Era by Rabbi Judah the Prince. Well, he didn't write it down himself necessarily. He compiled it. I think Rabbi Meir started the process of writing it down in about a generation before him. But he compiled it into one document called the Mishnah. So Mishnah is the oral Torah made written. The word Mishnah, we learned, means repetition. Because as oral law, as a body of oral tradition, prior to it being written down, the way that you learned it and transmitted it was by memorization. And memorization is accomplished by repetition. As the saying in the Mishnah, the student who repeats his lesson 100 times is not as noble as the student who repeats his lesson 101 times. We learned last week that that's the essential job of discipleship. A disciple's main purpose was to memorize vast amounts of text and teaching, and be able to recall those. And so, as we attempt to be disciples of Yeshua, now we know what our job is: memorize, repetition, Mishnah. Okay, so that was the Mishnah. We learned the Mishnah, and we read a short passage from the Mishnah last week. This week we're going to learn about the Talmud, and it's very closely related to the Mishnah. So here's the first thing I'm going to do. We're going to talk about what happened after Rabbi Judah the Prince wrote or compiled the Mishnah. Well, not everybody thought it was so great. Of course, there's all the old-timers who say, what? You can't write down an oral Torah. You can't write down oral tradition. It's not oral anymore, is it? So there's all these fellows. So. But then there was also people who objected that he had omitted things that should have been included, or he had... there was a lot of people who felt that he had... Well, and that's the obvious advantage to being the editor of any document, isn't it? You get to steer it yourself. So, for example, in the Mishnah, there's no mention of Hanukkah. Rabbi Judah the Prince didn't like Hanukkah. He was like the Grinch who stole Hanukkah. He didn't like Hanukkah. He thought, Hanukkah was... the problem with Hanukkah being that the Maccabees, they were priests and they made themselves kings and usurped the throne of David. They usurped the throne of David, and Rabbi Judah the Prince is a descendant of King David, a distant cousin of our master even. He didn't like Hanukkah for that reason. So you don't find Hanukkah in the Mishnah. Well, that's just one example. The sages who lived in the days before the writing of the Mishnah are called teachers. We call them teachers, and the word is Tanaim, the Tanaim. A Tana is a teacher. Tanaim, teachers, okay? So those are the teachers, because they were the ones who carried this body of oral tradition from who knows when, way back then, through memorization and passing it on and so on and so forth, right? So they are the teachers. And our Master Yeshua falls into that category of Tanaim. Basically, we're talking about all the sages of the late Second Temple era, all the way up to the writing of the Mishnah. Once the Mishnah is written, there's no more Tanaim. Well, if you were a Tana before the Mishnah was written, you were still a Tana till you died. But after that generation, there's no more Tanaim, no more teachers proper. From now on, if you're a sage or a rabbi, you're going to be called an Amora, the Amoraim, the sayers, like the Hebrew word Amar, to say, to speak. Why? Because these guys, after the writing of the Mishnah, they have no authority themselves. If you were a Tana, you could have, you had authority because you were carrying the oral tradition. You could have said, that's not how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be like this. And you could bring a correction. But now the sayers, they're not carrying that oral tradition. They don't have the authority to amend or change the Mishnah. So they are just going to report what they have heard from previous generations, without delivering an authoritative ruling, and that's why they're called the sayers. They say what people said before, the sayers. Okay, so sayers, the Amorim are they are sages from the time of the writing of the Mishnah up till the time of the completion of the document we're studying tonight, the Talmud. So they have about a 300-year run, much shorter than the Tanaim, who go all the way back to the beginning of the Second Temple era. All right. So I was telling you that not everybody was happy with the Mishnah. So what I have here is a competing version, another edition of the Mishnah that came out almost immediately, includes a lot of things that a lot of alternate rulings and alternate opinions that aren't in the Mishnah, but it follows the same order. It has the same orders as we learned last week, the same six chapters or six orders of the Mishnah, and it has a lot of similarities with the Mishnah. So it's like somebody took the Mishnah, and we know who it was. It was Rabbi Hia and his disciple Hosea. They took the Mishnah, and they said, we don't like that, we don't like that, and they put in as they heard it. So this is called the Tosefta. All right, so you'll hear this cited sometimes, Tosefta. Tosefta is like an alternative Mishnah. Tosefta means addition. So another way to put it is there are additions to the Mishnah in the Tosefta. Okay, you don't really have to be too worried about how am I going to remember all these terms. I'm just kind of throwing them out there for you.
Is Hanukkah
in the Tosefta? I'm not sure. That's a good question. It's a very good question. I'm not sure. Don't know. Yes.
So after, okay, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, he was the authority of the Sanhedrin?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So when the Tosefta was completed, he obviously didn't like that.
We don't really know.
So how did the Sanhedrin, did they govern the Mishnah?
Well, the Tosefta isn't necessarily contradicting the Mishnah as much as augmenting it and bringing in some alternative explanations and that sort of thing. So, an interesting thing about most of the material in the Mishnah and the Tosefta, for that matter, is that by the time it was being written down, it was not very relevant anymore. So it's all academic, theoretical, because there's no temple anymore. And a lot of it was just, and as we continue to work tonight, we're going to see that it's going to get even more academic as we continue.
What are those books you were holding up?
This is the Tosefta.
Okay.
Who compiled the Tosefta?
Rabbi Hia. Yeah, Rabbi Hia, he was part of Rabbi Yehuda's academy. Speaking of academies, two academies that we need to, well, there's many, 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 but two big academies, we're going to just generalize, that we need to keep in mind. All right, so the first one is the school of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. That's Rabbi Judah the Prince, as we've been discussing. He was the head of the academy of sages, of scholars, the Sanhedrin, as it were. The head of the academy of sages, scholars, and rabbis, judges, in the land of Israel. He had a student named Abba Arika. Abba Arika just means big daddy. He's very tall. Yeah. He was a very tall fellow. He was kind of a troublemaker. He was a caustic type of person. He kept trying to get ordination, but Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi would never ordain him. So Abba Arika eventually left for the diaspora. He went out to out into the the Parthian Empire and settled down in modern day Iraq, which at that time was referred to by the Jewish community and still is referred to by the Jewish community as Babylon, because that's the ancient land of Babylon. And so there's lots of, there's a great Jewish population, very large Jewish population out there. And he became a notable scholar in Babylon. You will encounter him, you'll never encounter him by the name Abba Arika in the Talmud. His name will always be just Rav. Rav. Yeah. Yeah. Rav, which means, revered one. Rav, but not rabbi. Why? Because he never received ordination. Yeah. So, he's Rav. He had a colleague that he studied with, and they had a falling out, and his colleague went and started another academy in Babylon. And you'll encounter him in the Talmud all the time under the name Shmuel. So these two are the heads of the academies of the sages in Babylon, Rav and Shmuel. And they always disagree on everything. They're like Hillel and Shammai of a new generation. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and his group are the heads of the academy in the land of Israel. And these two centers of Torah learning take the Mishnah, now, I'm taking the Mishnah in hand, they take the Mishnah as their textbook. Not that they didn't study the Bible and that sort of thing, of course they did, but they're taking the Mishnah as their textbook, their text that they need to study, and they're discussing it in the study halls with an objective. The objective is to figure out why the Tanaim ruled the way they did on all these different questions in the oral law. And what they want to accomplish is to find biblical proof texts for all of the decisions that the Tanaim made in putting together the Mishnah. And so what they're really doing is embarking on the biggest Bible study of all time. I mean, look at this thing. All of these laws, law after law after law after law, that constitute the Mishnah, and all of it must have a biblical basis. Somehow, somewhere. This is the thinking of the Amorim. So their objective is to find that biblical basis. Now, it's usually the biblical basis isn't stated in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah, after all, is not the written law, it's the oral law. But what is the relationship between the Mishnah, the oral law, and the written law? That's the objective. So we have two enormous Bible studies going. When I say enormous, I mean academies in Babylon, several academies. I think there's four academies in Babylon, and then a major academy in the land of Israel, all working on this problem simultaneously, of finding biblical proof texts to back up and to explain the decisions that are laid down in the Mishnah. Giant Bible study. Here's how they did it. All the rabbis at this time, all the rabbis and the sages, are agriculturalists. Well, not all of them. Like, there's Yossi the sandal maker and this sort of thing. But for the most part, most of these guys have land. And the agricultural year dictates their availability to sit around in a study hall and hang out with the guys and talk Torah. Turns out that they only have about a month, a year, to sit around and talk Torah. So, once a year, they gather, I suppose after the harvest, or something like this. They gather in these study halls, they come together, and they take on a tractate of the Mishnah. Like, the very first one, for example, is Brachot, which means blessings. It gives us all the laws, oral laws of liturgy, and all the traditions of the liturgy. And they say, okay, Brachot. Let's study Brachot. Let's figure out the biblical basis behind all these laws and that sort of thing. And what this is, you know, you've got these guys sitting around. They've got about a month, maybe a little more than a month to kill, sitting around in an academy, talking Torah. This is a problem. Anytime you get a bunch of guys together, sit around, with no real solid purpose. I mean, we do it all the time now. It's called football. Yeah, these guys didn't have football. You know, guys hang out. Guys look for an excuse to hang out. You know, a lot of guys don't really like golf, but they golf anyway because it's where they hang out with other guys. Yeah. So guys look. It's not so much what you do. It's just kind of like there's an excuse to hang out. You know, football is an excuse to hang out and drink beer and eat Cheetos, you know, or whatever it is, right? The sages, they didn't have these pastimes. They didn't have these entertainments. They had Torah. So they would hang out together and learn Torah and study Torah and talk Torah, and you know, which isn't so bad, you know? But it puts it on a different level. It puts it in a different place, I think. Bible study, the whole idea of Bible study. I mean, Bible study for me, I don't know about you, but for me, I grew up going to Bible studies. Bible studies worked like this. You open the Bible, you study the Bible, you're learning from the Bible, you read a little bit, and then the leader of the Bible study asks that leading question, how does this apply to us? All right? So... And if you couldn't find how it applied to you, there didn't seem to be much point to it, you know, so much point to that particular passage. And that's true, you know, we really, you know, we have this obligation to live these godly lives according to God's commandments. So we should be seeking the application when we come to the Word of God. That's true. But the sages had a different view. They weren't always worried about how this applies to us. They were interested in how did this apply to people when the temple was standing? And all sorts of academic questions that had no real practical application to their lives whatsoever. In their worldview, just the study of the scriptures, the study of Torah, and the Mishnah, in the view of the sages, is Torah. Okay? So the study of Torah, whether we're talking about the written Torah or the Mishnah, is a form of worship. And you're focusing your mind on Hashem, you're focusing your mind on God, you're talking about the scriptures as a form of worship, as a form of praise to God. And so the process of study itself had an intrinsic value in the mind of the rabbis. This doesn't exist in our world for the most part, you know. We would refer to this as, you know, theologians sitting in their ivory towers, in their lofty ivory towers. The reason I'm telling you this is because I want you to understand why, when you access a source like this, why so much of it seems to have so very little relevance. It doesn't need to have any relevance to anything. That wasn't their objective. They weren't writing Musar. Musar is another field of Jewish studies that's all about practical application. Musar means discipline, practical application for your life. They weren't writing that. They were lawyers working on legal material. You know that fine print you never read? They loved that. They loved fine print. They'd look at the fine print of every contract and they would say, how could we make this print finer? Right. And another way I think about it is I mentioned football before. You know, guys sitting around enjoying football. It's like football. What's the point? What's the point of football? I mean, isn't that? You know, when I'm watching football, I love watching football. But then, at a certain point, you know, it occurs to me, this doesn't matter at all. You know, you can be so into the game that you're just yelling at, you know, at them. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, this doesn't matter at all. Okay, but did you know there are people who go further than that? And they play fantasy football. Not only does this not matter at all because it's just football, this doesn't even exist. Right. Right, this is a whole imaginary football. You know what I'm saying? Okay, this is, guys love this kind of stuff. This is what guys do. And the Talmud and most of rabbinic literature bears the stamp of men, that men were enjoying themselves doing this. There's another thing that I notice when I read rabbinic literature that indicates that these were men at work. I call this rabbinic one-upmanship. So let's say we're trying to figure out the basis for a law in the Mishnah, you know, that's presented. And you say, well, you know where that comes from? That clearly comes from, here, let's try to pull out an example that would, okay, this is all fictitious, okay? Where does it say that we need to have 10 men to pray? I believe this is in Tractate Megillah, for real, but my fictitious version. Where does it say we need to have 10 men to pray? Well, the answer is that you have whenever Moses numbers off the people of Israel, the smallest denomination is a 10. You only go down to tens. So it says heads over thousands, heads over hundreds, heads over fifties, heads over tens. And it stops there. And so, these denominations have heads. They're congregations. They can function as a congregational unit. All right. So that'd be the first answer. So a sage would say this, okay. Someone says, okay, you think I can do one better than that. Abraham, when negotiating with God, negotiated, how many righteous men it would take to save Sodom and Gomorrah. He negotiated it down to 10. All right. The next guy says, no. You guys don't know what you're talking about. I can be even more obscure than that. And he'll say, this is where it comes from. Boaz, when he came into the gates of the city, and he needed to put together judges in order to marry Ruth, he called 10 men. This is where it's from. All right, so someone else is going to say, you guys, that's not it at all. I know something even more obscure. And it seems as if there was a certain machoism in finding the most obscure way to read a text that no one else had thought of before, or no one else had seen that before. And so this is why you'll very often have these, you read rabbinic literature, you read a proof text, and it's like, what? How did you get that from that? You know? And I think that's really a part of the process. I mean, this is just my theories, who knows? All right, so we have these study halls going on. Study halls over in the land of Israel, study halls in Babylon. Everybody's working on the Mishnah. They start off on a tractate, and there's all this arguing going on. Everybody's having a good time. They're arguing it back and forth. Somebody's taking notes. Somebody is taking notes on this process. They're arguing back and forth. A couple weeks later, attention spans are getting shorter. They realize they've only made it a few verses. Feelings have been hurt several times. People just want it to be over. And there's only a few weeks left before they need to do the planting. And so you'll notice this with every tractate of the Talmud, that it starts off with a lot of commentary on the first couple verses. And then it starts going very quickly towards the end to finish it off. And that's not only true in the Talmud. We also the same phenomenon in the Midrash on the Parsha, you know, and that sort of thing. But I think the reason is just because that represents a real human process of like let's take our time and do this really well. Let's just get this thing done. You know, it goes from that to that. Now, if you've ever been sitting around with guys while they're discussing something, you know that they have a hard time staying on one subject. Instead, it can kind of meander. I think women are the same. I think women are the same. But men, when we sit around and say, you know, well, let's talk about something. One subject brings up another subject. You kind of like go off, and you might do a big loop, like you start talking about this, and do this big loop, and go all the way, and just be like, pretty soon you're nowhere even close to the original subject matter. Instead, you're telling a story about a fishing trip that you were on, right? It's way over here, or something that your dad used to say, right? But then pretty soon, you come back to the original subject. Men are good at bringing it back to the original subject. I don't know if women are. But men are able to do that. They're able to, they can put that in their brain and say, we were talking about, and come back to it. Talmud works the same way. You'll find that the Talmud will begin by discussing a verse in the Mishnah, and then it might very quickly digress into something that doesn't, seem very on target. It kind of wanders off. I call these the rabbit trails, or my friend Grant Luton calls them the rabbi trails. Rabbi trails leading off. In the process of discussing a passage, if you were one of these sages, it would be pretty cool if you could bring an additional oral tradition that you've heard that, say, you know, one of the Tanaim used to say, and you've heard this additional oral tradition, and you could bring this as a proof text from outside of the Mishnah. So we have a lot of that. A lot. I mean, it's this great body of oral tradition was still floating around out there, you know, and surely Rabbi Judah didn't write everything down, and neither did the Tosefta get everything. So that you have a lot of that, a lot of the rabbis saying, I heard this. I heard this from my teacher. My teacher told me this. My teacher heard this from his teacher, who heard it from his teacher. And so you get these chains of authority. Another objective as we're working on the Mishnah in these study halls is that occasionally we'll encounter a contradiction or something that appears to be a contradiction. So it's our job, as that happens, we'll try to reconcile it, say, well, what did that mean? What did that mean? So I think that's it. I think that's the Bible studies. This goes on for a couple centuries. Really.